Good evening. Welcome.
Good evening.
So you've come on an auspicious day, the annual Memorial Day of Dogen and Keizan, kind of our two Japanese founders in medieval times in Japan, who brought this tradition to us. And we're taking the opportunity of this auspicious day to start what we call the fall practice period. So all time is a period for practice, but we specify these times in the year, in the fall and winter, as designated practice periods, which is just a time, setting aside a time, carving a limited time out of timelessness to say, during this time we're going to deepen our intention to practice. So some of you might be new to practice and just checking this place out, and so deepening practice is anything. If you're in that situation, you're lucky. And if we've been around longer, it's maybe harder, actually, to deepen our practice, because we might feel like, well, we're already doing all we can. But practice period is a time to see if we can do a little bit more than we think we can. More in the sense of not exactly better practice, because we don't judge better and worse in these kinds of things, but more see if we can just show up more. And you know, particularly here at a Zen center where we're having a community practice period, it's like show up more for the community events. We can also take the opportunity in a practice period to you know, do more Zazen meditation practice at home. And I think people do take such an opportunity. But particularly, we have a Zen center like this. It's time to come together and join the Sangha, the community, to practice more wholeheartedly as a group. So if you haven't already heard about how this works, basically you can treat it however you want. You can come on Wednesday nights and so on. If you'd like to you know, formalize a kind of commitment to the practice period, we have these forms out on the shoe rack out there. And I actually invite people who are brand new to Zen Center and want to spend the next 10 weeks, is how long it is, so a little more than a couple months, to try out deepening a commitment to practice. It's really about commitment, I think, actually. It's a very conventional world thing. We're just going to formulate a commitment to, you know, come to one more period of Zazen or something like that. But this kind of thing, these conventional commitments, seem to be of great benefit. People say after doing it that they feel like that actually really helped to have a form for deepening a commitment. And in a group situation, so we have these forms, and you can keep one half, and you can give one half to me, and we can see so that you'll feel like, well, now I feel like I really want to be there. And there's at least one other person knows I really want to be there. So if I don't, I'll feel like maybe I'm letting down people. So I really want to be there. And from my point of view, it's not for me to judge whether people are following up on their commitments or not, but just that you have that connection, you have that relationship, so that it's a together kind of thing. So I invite you, it's not too late, even though the practice period is now officially open, to fill out a form, and which basically is like, has a weekly calendar and a monthly calendar and so on. And also, we have what we call Sesshin, intensive silent meditation retreat, starting tomorrow to celebrate the beginning of this practice period. So for 5 days, we're having a Bodhidharma Memorial Sesshin. So these dates are coming from ancient tradition, and so between Dogen's memorial and Bodhidharma's memorial. Bodhidharma was the one who brought Zen from India to China centuries before Dogen. His memorial is on October 5th, so we'll end this sesshin with a ceremony for Bodhidharma, this great silent ancestor. And we'll celebrate his practice, which was sitting facing the wall. Bodhidharma apparently sat in this cave in China and just faced the wall of the cave for 9 years. And people said he was the embodiment of great compassion. So we can contemplate how silently facing the wall for 9 years or 5 days or a period of zazen is a manifestation of great compassion. And this sesshin and this whole practice period, at least for now, this current incarnation of Santa Cruz Zen Center, we're leaving everything very open. Like, you don't have to commit to a whole sesshin, for example. We're calling it informal in the sense that you can just drop in anytime through these 5 days. There's basically from 5 a.m. to 9 p.m. there'll be zazen happening, alternating with short walking meditations. And if enough people show up at around 10 in the morning, we'll have a Dharma talk. And if not enough do, we'll just keep sitting. And the schedule is posted on the bulletin board out there. So it's a completely open Bodhidharma style sesshin. You can just come and face the wall as you wish for the next 5 days. And I'll be here throughout, and maybe some other people will. So, wholehearted invitation. And we'll end this practice period in December with another sesshin, Rohatsu sesshin, celebrating Buddha's enlightenment. So that's a little bit what's going on. It's kind of a time of the year after a summer of not so much activity at Zen Center. We're kind of like, it's a different phase of the practice year starting today through the fall, and actually we take a little break, and then through the winter also, this practice season. So welcome. And I'd like to also just mention maybe a little bit about this trip that I just returned from. Shoho-san and I spent a month in India on pilgrimage to the Buddha's places, the places where Buddha lived and practiced. And it was a wonderful experience going to these places where Buddha was born, where the Buddha awakened under the Bodhi tree and first set in motion the wheel of Dharma, first taught and entered parinirvana and left his body. Particularly those four places, the Buddha himself said before he died, in the future, if my disciples visit these places, it will be conducive to increasing faith in the Dharma and these teachings of peace. And it did seem to be conducive to faith to go to the places where Buddha lived and feel the blessings of the Buddha and the myriad practitioners over many centuries after Buddha who have visited these places and blessed them with their practice energy. I think there's something to this idea of, you know, places having blessings. Like this Zendo, I feel like, is a place that's been blessed by great beings. Koben Chino Roshi, the founder of Santa Cruz Zen Center, spent many days in this Zendo. And many sesshins, many retreats have been here over the past 40 years, actually. That I guess it's been almost in this room, I think, for maybe 38 years, close to that. And there's a certain kind of energy created by the intention of many, many people wishing to let go of their fixed ideas over and over again in this place. To not take too long talking about this India trip, Maybe to sum it up, I would say one kind of image that seems to represent how it was for me was, and I think this image can apply to actually every situation, it just was revealed very clearly in India, was there's these sanctuaries of deep peace and open-hearted life and freedom and presence that are these, you know, the centers of these pilgrimage spots. Very peaceful, radiant locations, and they're surrounded by total chaos and total, like, poverty and sickness and, you know, leprosy, where people's limbs are falling off, and piles and piles of garbage that they haven't figured out how to deal with. Piles and piles of plastic bottles that they can't be recycled, and great need. India is really in these, particularly around these very sacred places, is a real kind of hungry ghost realm. Buddha's enlightenment place in Bodh Gaya is the poorest province of the whole country of India, which is pretty poor in general. So people are very needy, and when they see anyone from another country, they're automatically put into the category of supremely wealthy, even if they might be kind of poor travelers in, from our standards. So continuously surrounded by beggars asking for something in the material realm. And that was the entrance to these places of great peace and stillness. And I think that our lives are often this way. The places of peace and stillness, whether they be physical locations or mind locations. And I think an external pilgrimage can also be symbolized or lived as an internal pilgrimage to places of sacred places of stillness in the mind and heart. Such places are inevitably, even I would say, surrounded by these gateways of requests to us, and something that's calling for some response. So part of my intention for going on this pilgrimage was, knowing, having been to India before, knowing how this is, I thought, as well as celebrating Buddha's life and awakening at these places, to actually practice patience was part of my intention to go. And I definitely got the opportunity, and I failed many times. And but I got the opportunity again, right after failing. And it's an ongoing, endless thing. I felt many times that that the requests of these people, you know, with a deep intention to practice patience, I would meet them. I'd sometimes give them something. I'd sometimes wouldn't give them anything, but I'd stop and really look at them and offer them like a prayer, which they couldn't understand in English usually, but. You know, may you be well and happy and free from suffering and free from all desire. May you arouse bodhicitta, the mind of awakening that that just wishes to be free and at ease right now in whatever situation you're in. Such prayers and mantras. Om bodhicitta bodha hadayami. May you, the mantra for arousing the bodhi mind. To people and animals, many actually suffering animals too, very thin cows all over. The cow is sacred in India, it's never killed. So there's stray cows all over the city streets that stop the traffic, and all over the sidewalks, sometimes wandering into restaurants these huge animals, and they're just on their own, just like the people. It seems to be no pets in India. It's just like there's dogs everywhere and cows everywhere, but they just live off garbage as they can find it and try to make do just as the people. So many needy beings, and trying to really meet them and trying to practice patience, and then, you know, offering such prayers, trying to really come from my heart as I do so. Try to give something really from the heart, really with the wish that they be well, and feeling like, wow, yeah, I'm doing it, I really feel sincere. And then like, are we done yet? Like, is this person going to leave now? They got their blessing. No, they're not going to leave. They're going to follow me for half a mile, continually asking, as I continually open-heartedly say, may you be well and happy. But my patience begins to wear more and more thin until I'm saying, may you be happy! And getting to that point, or, you know, saying these mantras in a somewhat energetic way that didn't necessarily seem so helpful after a while, and then feeling not good about it and confessing and repenting and then being offered another chance. Oh, luckily, how great, another beggar 10 seconds later has come to me, so I can try again. Yes, I can do it this time. I can do it. I'm losing it. So again and again, and finally you get to the temple gates, and they usually don't come inside, and there's a relief just communing with Buddha's peaceful energy, sitting zazen, becoming very settled and present, and feeling like India is the most peaceful realm in the universe, and then walking out the gate again and facing it all again. So I do think that our lives, you know, I mean, it's an extreme version, but our lives are often this way, that there always is a peaceful place. And sometimes it's right in the midst of all these needy beings, whether there be aspects of ourself sometime. Like we'll do this ceremony this fall, a ceremony around Halloween time for feeding hungry ghosts, an ancient Zen ceremony. And we talk about it like we're wishing to nourish all hungry beings in the world, but also the hungry parts of ourselves. And patience, I think, really is the practice here. And this pilgrimage was great grounds for patience. Sometimes they say that difficult living beings are the greatest gift for a bodhisattva, for one trying to practice Buddha's way for the benefit of all beings. They need difficult people around them, because otherwise you can't practice patience. We need difficult beings, or else everything's going along nicely, and maybe we don't wish for difficult beings, but in a way a bodhisattva, maybe they don't have to wish for exactly, but they're just completely opened to difficult beings and internal and external beings. And because it's this great opportunity to practice patience. And patience is basically just acceptance of what's happening. And in this situation of all these very poor, sick, and needy people, there can be thoughts of like, I wish this wasn't happening. I wish the situation wasn't like this. Or I wish I could feed them all. But it's impossible. It's like way beyond impossible. So the patience is like deeply accepting the situation as it is. These people cannot be all fed. But I can try to feed some of them and wish them well. And keep my heart open to them is the main thing. The main practice. They might not feel immediately like, oh, I don't care. You know, they might feel, I don't care if your heart's open or not. I just want some food. And in fact, there were different types of people. Some we got to know, in particular in Bodh Gaya, some regulars in amongst the beggars. And some would respond, when we do these kind of blessings and mantras without giving them any food, they would immediately, when we'd start, they'd just go, and they'd start like walking away, like, I don't care, I don't want your blessing. Some people were more serene and just would sit there and receive it, whatever came to them. So I think it's an ongoing question of how to respond to the world, but the only conclusion I've come to so far really is to just leave the heart as open as possible, and not knowing mind, not knowing how to respond, but just an open heart and willing to meet each situation anew and respond freshly. Which, you know, it wasn't always the same response. It was like, here's the same person again, but what do they need right now, or what can I give them right now? And so this not knowing, open-hearted mind brings me to the topic of Bodhidharma. So this session we start tomorrow, celebrating Bodhidharma's teachings, and if we have Dharma talks, we'll maybe get into some of Bodhidharma's teachings. But here's a little bit just about the spirit of this great Indian teacher Bodhidharma, who risked his life to travel from India to China by ship. Apparently there were the Huns at that time living, you know, through India and China, and to cross by land was too dangerous. So he went by ship way around through Southeast Asia, and it apparently took 3 years at that time by ship, very slow ship. And Dogen has wonderful passages extolling the virtues of Bodhidharma's efforts and basically risking his life on a ship in those days to bring Dharma to China, particularly to bring Zen to China. There was already Buddhism happening, but more like scholastic Buddhism, and the true heart of presence had been somewhat lost or had been degenerating over time. And so Bodhidharma's emphasis when he got there, he talked a little bit, but mainly he just sat facing the wall. People called him the wall-gazing Brahmin because he was this Indian and they didn't know what he was doing. So there's various writings of Bodhidharma that may or may not have been written by him. This is the 5th century, so 1500 years ago. The records were sparse. But there's one text, a short text, that most present-day scholars agree that if there's some writing that's authentically written by this person called Bodhidharma, this is probably the one. And it's an outline of practice, the whole path of practice in a few pages. And so briefly, Bodhidharma says, many roads lead to the path, the way, but basically there's only two, principle and practice, or reason and practice. And to enter by principle, or reason, means to realize the source through instruction, through some teaching, to understand the source of everything and to trust that all living things share the same true nature, which isn't apparent because it's shrouded by delusion. But those who turn from delusion to reality, who contemplate walls, this is his practice, wall contemplation, who contemplate the absence of self and other, the oneness of ordinary and holy, mortal and sage, and who remain unmoved by scriptures and teachings because they trust reality so deeply, they are in complete and unspoken agreement with principle. Without moving, without effort, they enter, we say, by principle. So this is like without any particular practice, just realize this is it. Everything is as it is. Nothing is lacking. the needy beings of the world are arising and ceasing as they do. This body and mind is arising and ceasing as it does. And there's no self and others that can be found anywhere. And that's rare, to just enter by a principle in such a way without practice. So then, Bodhidharma compassionately offers four practices to enter by practice. And they kind of go along with the Buddha's teaching of the Four Noble Truths loosely, but they're kind of practices loosely based on these four truths. He doesn't say that, but you can see if you can see these truths in here. The first practice is suffering injustice. When those who search for the way encounter adversity, they should think to themselves, in countless ages gone by, I've turned from the essential to the trivial and wandered through all manner of existence, often angry without cause and guilty of numberless transgressions. Now, though I do no wrong, I'm punished by my past. This is kind of the laws of karma. I've done all these things in the past, maybe even past lives, but probably I've gotten angry some in this life too, and now it's coming back to me, and things are difficult. And you know, whether you believe in cause and effect in such a linear way as that, or not, I think is not the key point here. I think the key point here is just when difficulty comes to us, injustice comes to us, unfairness comes, we just accept it. This is entering the way by practice. I accept it with an open heart and without complaint of injustice. That's the practice. Interesting. We don't often hear Zen teaching stated in such a direct way as this. I think it's a kind of unusual teaching. But this is our Zen founder. Basically, injustice, or even what we perceive as justice, we just accept with an open heart whatever's happening. And we don't complain that it doesn't seem fair. Second is the practice of adapting to conditions. As sentient beings, we're ruled by conditions, not by ourselves. All the suffering and joy we experience depends on conditions. If we should be blessed by some great reward, such as fame or fortune, it's the fruit of a seed planted in the past. When conditions change, it ends. Why delight in its existence? So not only so when suffering comes, but when happiness comes, it's all impermanent, everything's changing. So the practice of adapting to conditions, or kind of harmonizing with conditions, which is, so the causes of suffering are these conditions, and the causes of happiness are these conditions. And so not only do we accept the suffering that's coming to us, but we just accord with the conditions arising moment to moment. Those who remain unmoved by the wind of joy or winds of trouble silently follow the path. That's it. Also, all of these practices, these four practices, you could also hear them as Zazen instruction. To suffer injustice during Zazen, when you're thinking about, why, I can't believe that person said that to me. Like, it totally was wrong. Like, no, I'll just sit with what's happening. And in this case, according with conditions, you know, my legs hurt, I can't concentrate, or it's a really great period, or it's not as good as yesterday, whatever. We're just according with conditions, sitting in the midst of conditions, silently following the way. Bodhidharma's 9 years of facing the wall, adapting to conditions, the snow and the sun and everything. Third practice is seeking nothing. People of this world are deluded. They're always longing for something, always, in a word, seeking. But the wise wake up, they choose reason over custom. They fix their minds on the sublime and let their bodies change with the seasons. All phenomena are empty. They contain nothing worth grasping. Calamity forever alternates with prosperity. To dwell in the three realms of samsara is to dwell in a burning house. To have a body is to suffer. So those who understand this, let go from all that exists and stop imagining or seeking anything. The sutras say to seek is to suffer, to seek nothing is bliss. When you seek nothing, you're on the path. So this could be equated with the third noble truth of the cessation of suffering, or nirvana, which is the cessation of seeking, desiring, craving, grasping anything, just letting be. Again, another description of Zazen. Maybe most beautiful, clear, straightforward explanation of Zazen, which appears again and again in this form in the Zen tradition. Just not seeking anything. Just being with what is. And to enact this again and again in Zazen is why we hold sesshins and so on. It's easy to practice for a moment, but over and over again, there's no end to letting go of seeking. And fourth, practicing the Dharma. The Dharma is the truth that all nature is pure. By this truth, all appearances are empty. Defilement and attachment, subject and object, don't truly exist. And so bodhisattvas help others along the way to awakening, and they practice giving and the other paramitas, the other virtues of ethical conduct, patience, diligent enthusiasm and concentration and wisdom. But while they practice these six paramitas, they practice nothing at all. That's what's meant by practicing the Dharma. So helping in whatever way we can, and at the same time, nothing's truly happening. Is, and that kind of circles back to Bodhidharma's first entry of to the way through principle, is realizing that truly nothing's happening. And in this realm where nothing's happening, we practice these paramitas of generosity and patience and enthusiasm and virtue, concentration, with the understanding that everything is already in accord with everything else. So this next week we can practice Bodhidharma's teachings in this way, particularly not grasping or seeking anything, just sitting upright with nothing to be done. Just have a little bit of time left. Is there anything anyone would like to ask or bring up about the practice period, about Bodhidharma, about India, or anything else? Yes.
Are those practices one after another, or does one gravitate towards one or another?
Maybe one could take up those descriptions one at a time and raise the intention to practice in accord with that description of the teaching, but they all actually seem to be saying the same thing in different ways, I would say. You know, to suffer injustice, to accord with conditions, to seek nothing, and to practice Dharma, or realize that everything is as it is. All those seem like four descriptions of the same practice to me. And we could expand it to say that all the, you know, infinite Zen teachings that arose after this are all saying the same thing too. This practice is very, very simple. So for people coming newly to practice, I don't know, I see some unfamiliar faces, and if people are just coming to Zen practice, I would say that it might sound complicated, but at its heart, this practice is incredibly simple. And I think that the one thing to remember of these practices, the one that strikes me the most, is just like the trademark of Zen is just not seeking anything. And one moment of not seeking anything is a moment of total peace. It's like nothing's lacking. We're content with what is. But the types of seeking are incredibly vast and intricate and subtle, and we can fool ourselves in so many ways. Even seeking the non-seeking mind, for example. So it's endless practice, deepening, non-seeking. Very simple, but all these descriptions come down to the same thing. But we have to enact it. We have to live it moment by moment. In Zazen and out of Zazen. Yes?
Well, I'm thinking about the beggars, and I'm thinking about hunger. And I'm thinking, if I was really hungry, would I want someone to just wish me well?
Mm-hmm.
Would I really want to press them to give me some food? It's like, I know you could give me food.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't you giving me food?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, of course, you can't feed everybody. You can't feed a multitude. And I wonder, how did you work with that edge of hunger and experiencing? I mean, I know from my own experience in that realm, which is very limited, that, you know, there's probably variations of hunger. And, you know, there's people who are desperately hungry and people who, you know, that's how they earn their living.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
But you can't, and I know we talked a little about this, if you get too much into thinking about it, then it's like you're pretending you're some kind of God who can understand others, the motivations mm-hmm. of others, and we don't know.
It was very easy to get into judgments about, this person doesn't look like they really need something. And many, many people are making their business in this way, and they also have, you know, other sources of income and so on. So it's very challenging in that way. So for me, I felt like my intention was that I would fail at sometimes, but was to really not try to discern whether somebody needed something or not. And just like, I could see my mind would go there a lot. And it's like, no, this person and then this person are, you know, go down the line until I run out of change, and then like there's no more, which is also a painful situation because often they're in long lines, and then the people at the end of the line like, okay, me now, like, no, sorry, no more. And also when you say, like, I think that's true, that those people, they don't want a blessing, they just want food, but I think they also understand the situation. They know there's hundreds of others of them around. They know there's many, many other foreigners coming who don't give them anything. So they're completely used to that too. So I think there is a way that some of them really would practice. They weren't expecting. They weren't expecting in these places where there were a lot of people coming and going. If they got something, they were fine. And if they didn't, it was also, maybe this is my projection, but it was also okay. And they, you know, if they were there all day, they got enough to eat from hundreds of people going by. So, and they might have actually appreciated some feeling of heartfelt, like, you know, bowing. We did a lot of bowing, which they understand this signal in India as a gesture of respect. So really, like, stopping and sincerely, like, deeply bowing, like, you know, may you be well. And I think sometimes, I don't know, do people ever return the bow? I mean, no. But my feeling was that sometimes that was okay for people. They were alive, and we were just there for a short time, and they're continuing to do that year after year. And so, whether I personally gave them something or not, this is a much vaster thing going on.
Well, another thing that I'm thinking as you're talking is just how important I think it is to not objectify. How easy it is to objectify in a situation like that, you know, the beggars and the non-beggars.
Yes, yeah.
And I think there's a sense of humanity, though, where we're all on the same boat.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it's just a very, it's disturbing in a good way.
And it did,
for me to think about, you know, what you're bringing up and just kind of not closing mm-hmm. my heart to thinking about that.
Mm-hmm. And some of these boundaries were broken down around Bodh Gaya, I'm thinking in particular. There's all these Buddhist monks and nuns and lay people practicing, and And so there's the monks out there in the morning with their alms bowls, collecting food along with the beggars. And the beggars are going to the monks asking for money. And the monks are there with the bowl. You know, technically maybe the beggars should put food in their bowl. And then there's like, then there's us practicing as ordained people with more resources and mostly giving to the monks and the beggars and like, which is better? And then occasionally, maybe once, some Tibetan layperson gave me a kind of a big offering in the temple, money, and I was like, this shouldn't be happening, you know? This is like reverse, but it was kind of mixed up in that way. And then I just went out the gate and just changed it to a bunch of change and immediately spread it out over all these beggars. So it was beautiful in that way, that those boundaries in that way did break down. And also the questions of like, we're kind of like a big practice there at these Buddhist sites is basically making offerings. There's a little bit of meditation going on, but mostly people are doing these devotional practices. And so then there's all these, some of the poor people have realized that they can go cut lotus flowers in the morning and sell them for quite a bit, these beautiful, freshly bloomed lotus flowers early in the morning. And you can buy them, and then you go offer them to the Buddha, and the cost of the flower could, you know, pay for maybe somebody's meal for the day. It's not very much, but the food's not very much either. So these questions would come up, I shouldn't be giving to this flower to the Buddha that's getting piled up in these giant offerings from hundreds of people, and every half hour they like sweep the pile of flowers into a garbage bag and just schlep it off to throw it away so a new pile can build up. So it's like, that's a waste of a flower and money. And then I could be giving to these poor people, and then you get to the poor people and you go in without a flower to the Buddha, and it feels like, I should have spent that money on a flower. Like, these people are like, this is ongoing. They're getting their food to eat somehow, and they're coming and going, but like, we're meeting the Buddha here, and we like want to make an offering to the awakened mind in a sincere way. That's what we came here to do. So, I'm like, and then you give the flower to the Buddha, and you're like, wait a second, what am I doing? So these things are always part of the mix, too. It was beautiful, like no set fixed way of living in this world in general, right? So again, I wholeheartedly invite everyone, particularly people just checking out the Zen Center, to come again whenever you like. We have a whole array of events happening through the fall and winter, and on the website and calendar and so on. And may the blessings of Shakyamuni Buddha carried from these holy places in India, and the blessings of Bodhidharma and his practice of non-seeking and facing the wall, unmoving, and the blessings of Dogen and Keizan on this their Memorial Day fill us all with great peace and joy. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it.